Wired.com presents The Geek's Guide to the Galaxy. And here is your host, David Barr Kirtley.
Hello, and welcome to episode 228 of Geek's Guide to the Galaxy. Our guest today is T.C. Boyle. He's the author of 15 novels, including The Road to Wellville, A Friend of the Earth, Drop City, and The Harder They Come. He's also written over 100 short stories, which have been published in collections such as After the Plague, Tooth and Claw, and Wild Child and Other Stories. He's a distinguished professor of English emeritus at the University of Southern California, and for many years he taught a fiction workshop there that I was lucky enough to attend back in 2007. And I'll be speaking with him today about his new novel, The Terranauts. And now, here's our interview with T.C. Boyle. All right, so we're here with T.C. Boyle. Welcome to the show.
Well, David, it's a pleasure to be with you.
Okay, and so your new book is called The Terranauts, and it's loosely based on the real-life story of Biosphere 2. So tell us about Biosphere 2.
Well, this is a very happy accident for a writer to discover such wonderful material. I am able to take the actual Biosphere 2 material, which is now in the historical record, and then posit another closure of the biosphere with fictional characters. So many will remember that in the early 90s, specifically 91 through 93, the Biosphere 2 experiment began in the Arizona desert. You had a glassed-in enclosure of 3.15 acres, which contained 3,800 species of plants and animals, and five separate biomes. In it were four men and four women volunteers who were called the Biospherians. In my fictional account, I call them the Terranauts. And the object of this was to see if we could create a self-replicating biosphere, to see if we could have a Mars colony, or if the biosphere that we live in and are talking in now should collapse, which it seems to be well on its way to doing. Well, perhaps we could create our own glassed-in biospheres.
Right, and this got a lot of publicity at the time. I mean, I remember it. It was a big deal.
It was huge. I thought I'd write about it back then. I clipped out all the articles from the newspapers and magazines and so on. And NASA was involved early on, although this was completely privately funded by a friendly billionaire. And they aped NASA in terms of the way they publicized it, in terms of the big celebration with bands playing and celebrities and so on when they went in for their closure. It was a huge deal, and these people fought. They fought each other and competed to be one of the eight. There was an initial group of 16. They trained together, but finally, mission control of the biosphere selected eight.
Right,
which means that eight were excluded.
Well, you mentioned celebrities, and in the book you have William Burroughs present at one of these things. Was he actually involved?
Yes, he was. What is fascinating about the biosphere experiment was that it was not government controlled, and it was not NASA. It was private. It was whimsical. And John Allen, the founder of it, had roots in theater. He was a kind of guru. He was very much a New Age kind of guy. And this whole thing had a little bit of that New Age woo-wooism to it, which I think made NASA very nervous ultimately.
Right. I mean, like, so you say in the book that that William Burroughs was always talking about space and the future and how humans should evolve to leave the planet in, quote, astral dream bodies.
Yes. And see, this kind of thing tended to make NASA rather nervous, and they did back off their support of the thing. But at first, they were very encouraging. You may know also, David, that NASA is still pursuing the notion of giving us an off-Earth colony, specifically in Mars. Of course, you know, we also have a friendly billionaire like Elon Musk with his own vision. And I think you have to look at the Biospherians in a similar way to someone like Musk. At any rate, NASA just concluded a one-year closure in the Mauna Loa crater in Hawaii, in which six men and women, spent 1 year confined. They were, however, allowed to leave, but only if they were wearing spacesuits, so as to simulate what it might be like in a truly alien environment. Whereas the real hook, I think, of the biosphere was that there was absolute closure. And in fact, they perfected this so that it actually had less transference of outside air than the space shuttle. So they really did a great job with this.
Right, but then the original experiment, it went wrong very quickly.
Yeah. So as I point out in the book, because I am using the real history from the first mission to give a foundation to my fictional second mission, within 12 days, one of the women nearly cut off the tip of her finger in the rice huller. Now, of course, one of the eight must be a physician, and he sewed it back together and did his best. However, it wasn't looking too good, and she held it up to the glass of the visitor's window for the best handman in Pima County to come and look at it. And he said, "You're going to lose that unless you come out and go to the hospital." And so she did. 12 days into an absolute material closure of 2 years, this woman spent 5 hours out in Biosphere 1, that is where we live. All of the rest of the Earth is Biosphere 1, which is why they call their enclosure Biosphere 2, a new Earth altogether. And that kind of blew it in the public imagination, including in my imagination. So I did not pursue writing it in that era, even though I'd collected a lot of information. It was a kind of hook. It was theatrical. It was fascinating to think that this is a life and death situation. Yes, at any moment, they could get bored, they could argue with one another, they could be sick, they could get tired of being enclosed and open the airlock and walk right out into our world. But they didn't, or shouldn't have. And I think in the public imagination, the whole thing was rather corrupted at that point. And as you know, in the second year, they began to pipe in oxygen because they could not fully maintain the proper O2-CO2 ratios. And it was as if they were living at high altitude and people began to get headaches and they couldn't sleep and they got sick and so on. And also, another detail that fascinates me is that at first, all the lab work was done in-house. And it would then be, presumably after 2 years, would be removed and tested. So they had their blood tested constantly and so on. But once closure had been broken, they began to send the samples out to an outside lab because it was easier that way. Twice during this process, flu entered into the biosphere, and they all got sick, simply because someone hadn't properly washed his hands when sending the test tubes back in. It's just fascinating.
Yeah, it seems like there's all sorts of problems with these, you know, when you have these people in a small space all stuck together for a long time, right? You talk about there was this Antarctic research station where the people there split into two gangs and brawled over what movie to watch and things like that.
Exactly. So it's not simply what NASA is doing and what the Biosphere 2 had done. But there are other experiments in closure and close living in alien conditions. And, of course, the reports of the Antarctic scientists who have to overwinter for 6 months and so on give kind of rich fodder for all of this. We still don't know what the psychological repercussions are, of course, of enclosing people in an alien atmosphere.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned that there was sort of a weird New Age aspect to this Biosphere 2. And I know you've written about cults in the past. Do you see this as a sort of cult?
Well, there are three I narrators, which I've never quite tried before, but it works for me because each one, it's very intimate. Each one is speaking directly to you and contradicting the others and giving their innermost thoughts and so on. And the male, who is the second narrator, Ramsey Ruthorpe, begins by talking about just that sort of thing.
And so what do you think? I mean, do you have an opinion on whether this was sort of a cult or not?
He denies it, but of course it was a cult. And mission control is very interfering. Not only are these people observed by tourists through the glass, but mission control is in charge of everything they do. They deny that they were a cult, but of course, I mean, is the Marine Corps a cult? Yes, I think so. It's anything like this where you've got is NASA a cult? You've got a group of people desperately vying for a spot on this mission. Of course, they all believe in ecological advancement, as I do, but they can't help falling into line under the regimen of the big bosses. And in my telling, I call the creator of this, who is not based on John Allen, by the way. This is not a Romana Clay. I don't know the original Biospherians at all, in my telling. But there is a creator and there is a billionaire. And in my telling, the creator, Jeremiah Reed, is known amongst the Terranauts as GC, short for God the Creator, just as the billionaire financier is known as GF, God the Financier.
Now, see, I had always heard one of the criteria for defining something as a cult is that they try to cut you off from any sort of contact with anyone outside the cult.
Yes. And in the actual biosphere, it wasn't as severe as what I have projected. In my projection, for my own purposes as a fiction writer, I have done exactly that. This is just before cell phones were available, and computers were, you know, not quite in their infancy, but nothing like we have now. And in the original Biosphere 2, computers were allowed, and TV broadcast and so on. In my telling, though, I'm more interested in having the leaders of this, GC and his inamorata, Judy, and little Jesus, the right-hand man on the outside crew, cut them off so that they are not able to communicate with the outside world except very rigidly and on the terms of mission control.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned that when this was going on that you were really interested in it. Do you wish that it had succeeded, or do you think someone should try it again? Or
absolutely, David. Here is what's so interesting about this, and you as a science fiction writer, I think, can really appreciate this. This was tremendous chutzpah. This was a kind of mix-and-match world, 3,800 species, but in five different biomes. And the species were not necessarily species that evolved with one another. This was a kind of mix-and-match world. So that, for instance, they put in galagos, the bush babies from Africa, this tiny pre-simian creature. Why? Well, for fun, for amusement, so they could watch them hurtling through the trees. As an ecologist, I would think to make such an experiment, you would take one biome. For instance, they lifted a lot of material from the Florida Everglades for their swamp. They trucked it in. It's just astonishing what they did. They trucked it all the way across country with you know, with mud and plants and the creatures and so on. It would make sense to have only a single biome, let's say the Florida Everglades, because this is where all the creatures and the plants have evolved for time immemorial. But they didn't want to do that. They wanted to represent the major biomes of the Earth, because in their hubris, they were trying to create a second Earth. So, you know, Biosphere 2 and, in my telling, Ecosphere 2. What also is so interesting is, what if we had 10 friendly billionaires and they had made 10 of these things a mile apart? And even if they included pretty much the same biomes, it would have been radically different because of accident and evolution. And don't forget, the original program of Biosphere 2, and as I explained in my fictional account, is for 50 two-year closures. This was meant to last for 100 years. Imagine if the Biosphere 2 were still enclosed. This is, you know, a quarter century on. Imagine, just in that time, what that that environment inside that would look like. It's stunning. But in the real history of this, the second closure only lasted 6 months, and that was the end of it because the friendly billionaire and the creator had a falling out, and the plug was pulled on it, and that was it. You can visit it now. It's northeast of Tucson, and it's a tourist site. It's owned by the University of Arizona now. They'll take you on little tours. The rainforest is still there. The major biomes are still there. And, you know, it's used for various soil and plant experiments. But it is not enclosed, and I expect never will be again.
But so you think the hubris was trying to put too many biomes into it? You think if it had been just one biome, it would have been all right? Or was there other hubris involved?
No. No, I'm not saying that. I'm just kind of wishing, you know, or wondering and wondering why it would proceed in this way. Again, if we were to make an off-Earth colony or a kind of biomes under glass on this Earth to save us when, you know, the biosphere collapses, they might necessarily be mix and match kind of worlds. Here I am in San Francisco talking to you. San Francisco Bay, 95% of the species dwelling in San Francisco Bay are invasive species. So we are, you know, and I've written about this many times, when the killing's done, for instance, on the Channel Islands, where, you know, what are the ethics of removing invasive species, that is, killing the animals? Really, the whole world is a kind of mix-and-match biome now, where we've taken creatures from regions where they would never encounter one another, and we sort of have a much smaller Earth now with a smaller suite of creatures on it. So, in some sense, the Biosphere 2 people were just doing what we are doing willy-nilly to the world anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I'm really intrigued by this. I would, yeah, like you said, I would love it if there were 10 of these things and we could try out different things. And the characters in the book mentioned that maybe living in one of these would add 10 years to your life because you would be shielded from pollution and disease and things like that.
Exactly. But don't forget, I am, again, in the real history of this, as I point out in the novel, their blood tests showed that their bloodstreams were flooded with DDT and other pervasive chemicals and pesticides that we all are ingesting at all times. And the reason for that is they lost a lot of weight. The men typically 18% of their body fat, the women 10%, because they were essentially living a subsistence kind of existence under the glass, even though outside they were spending over $1 million a year on electricity to keep the fans and blowers and everything else running. The Terranauts themselves were starving. They were burning more calories than they were taking in. And once that happened, the chemicals that are stored in our fat then were released into the bloodstream. So in that lesson alone from the original Biosphere 2, it kind of rings a warning bell about what's going on in all of our bodies on this Earth.
Right, and they were getting beta-carotene poisoning or something, right? Because you mentioned their skin's turning orange.
Yeah, their diet was very heavy on yams, for instance. There were few crops that they could grow consistently, and they needed calories. And yes, they all took on a faintly orange glow from, I don't know if they were being poisoned, but from a tremendous excess of beta carotene.
Huh. So, I mean, do you think this is a workable though? I mean, do you think in 10 or 20 years someone might take another shot at this?
I hope so. I hope so. I don't know by work what we mean really. Wow.
Well, the people would be healthy inside, right? And it would be self-sustaining.
I think it's possible, and I think that the Biosphere 2 experiment, which is, of course, poo-pooed because it really wasn't science. That is, science posits a theory, and then you test whether it's true or not. This was more a free-form thing like, Hey kids, let's put on a show. What if we do this? And hell, let's throw some Galagos in and see what happens. But really, it did have consequences that were so interesting to any kind of future experiment like this, because, as we were just saying, just that alone—that look what happens to your bloodstream when the fat is gone. And what about beta carotene poisoning? What about the protein? Protein was at a minimum. They had dwarf goats to milk, so they get milk. They had chickens. They had some pigs. The pigs in the actual biosphere experiment had to be slaughtered within the first year because they couldn't feed them anymore. So, yeah, if there were a second closure and a third closure and a fourth closure, each incoming crew could tinker with that sort of thing. And of course, it wouldn't be an absolute closed world. You know, the creatures that are already in there, they would leave in there, but they might add creatures, and they would certainly bring in poultry and goats and so on.
It was interesting because you mentioned in the book, yeah, that they had the dwarf pigs and goats and things, because these animals evolve in environments where there's not a lot of resources, because you need less resources than to keep them alive. So I wonder, should they have just, you know, could we just genetically engineer some very small people to live in the biosphere?
Yeah.
And they would.
Yeah, good question, because now, of course, we will be genetically engineering people, no matter what the scientists are telling us, now that we have CRISPR-Cas9 technology. Yeah, that's not such a bad idea. You have a 3.15-acre enclosure, but you just genetically engineer people so they're only a foot tall, you know, and they'll eat a lot less. And then one of these dwarf goats would be like a dinosaur to them, and they could milk it forever.
Yeah. See, I think that's like, if there are any billionaires listening to this, I mean, and they want to invest in our project here, I think we've got a good proposal here.
Yeah. Okay, David, but I'm not going to be enclosed. I've been asked this by journalists this past week since the book has come out. And of course, it's a kind of a horror movie scenario to me to be enclosed in anything. I am a nature boy. I need to be out by myself in the wilderness as much as possible, muttering to myself, brooding, letting my conscious mind go and experiencing what nature is. Now, of course, in the original biosphere and the one that I'm creating, the Ecosphere 2, there are little nooks and crannies where people can hide out, and it was quite beautiful inside. You know, they had a waterfall, they had their, what they called their ocean, which was a huge aquarium pool of salt water. The rainforest was quite beautiful. So they could experience nature, but it's not the nature that we know. It's a nature that's glassed in, and one of the problems with growing the crops is, yes, it's the Arizona desert, 330 days of sun a year, etc. But something like 40% of the sun's rays are blocked by the glass, and the bees to pollinate. They had to hand pollinate crops eventually because the bees died off, and it turns out that bees need ultraviolet light in order to find their way around, and the glass blocked it, or much of it. So yeah, I mean, it was valid because we discover all of these things that make it so difficult to create a world. And by the way, you may know, when NASA did this latest closure they had, so you project a year back from August, Elizabeth Colbert, the wonderful environmental writer who writes often in The New Yorker, wrote a little piece about it. And the idea of NASA doing this with an eye toward having a Mars colony. And she pointed out how almost impossible it would be to create a biosphere like the one that we live in, which has evolved in this way and allowed our species to evolve and thrive and be here talking on the telephone today. And her point as an environmentalist was, maybe we should just take a little bit better care of the one that we live in now, because it is almost impossible to create another one.
Well, I think that's certainly true. But when you said that you wouldn't want to be inside one of these things, that assumes that life outside is reasonably acceptable, right? But if there was nuclear fallout or somebody had genetically engineered some sort of super swine flu or something, that might
change.
Which
is coming. Which is absolutely coming. Well, don't forget, I write about this a lot. In 2000, I wrote A Friend of the Earth, projecting to 2026 about global warming and écotage. I mean, is it viable and ethical to stop the damage by illegal means and so on? I've devised my own plan, of course, for dealing with all of this, and that is I'm simply going to die.
Yes.
It makes it very simple, right? Why worry about it? I understand your question, though. For self-preservation, we might have to go. I watched Dr. Strangelove, one of my favorite movies, which still holds up, on a big screen this past summer. One of our old theaters revived it. It was fun to watch for many reasons, but also because a lot of the audience had never seen it before, and I could get off on their reactions. But if you recall, at the end, once the doomsday machine has gone off and the Earth is going to be destroyed, Dr. Strangelove himself says to the gathered, the bigwigs of the army and science and so on, he says, well, you know, we will have to repopulate the Earth and we will need 20 women for every man, you know. And they all get this little smile on their faces. Sure, it's it's going to be very exclusive. And that's another thing about the biosphere experiment that I'm playing with here. It was essentially white people, you know. Linda Ryu, who is excluded and promised to come in the third, is Korean. But this is essentially a whole Caucasian thing because that's the way the world was back then, and they didn't even think about including other races or anyone else. So if the world did turn to shit, or we did have to have various colonies, well, who is excluded? There are more than 7 billion of us on the planet, so we would all be left to die in any case. It's very elitist.
Well, no, this thing cost $150 million or something to build, so you're imagining a tiny, tiny number of people living inside these while everyone on the outside is, dying of toxic atmosphere.
You're right, like David, that. But if you and I were on the outside dying of a toxic atmosphere, wouldn't we tend to take the axe we normally use to chop firewood and blast through these damn walls and eat everything inside?
Yeah.
So they'd have to have systems to keep everybody out, and now we're getting into Mad Max territory already, you know?
Yeah, well, I wanted to ask you about that because I went back last night and reread a couple of your stories that I think would really appeal to our audience. Mm-hmm. And one of them was After the Plague. And
yes.
there's a line in there where the character says he's not a big fan of Mad Max type movies and things like that. I was just wondering how you personally, does that express your view or not?
After the Plague was written in the run-up to A Friend of the Earth. I believe I wrote it before A Friend of the Earth, but then it was in the collection After the Plague, the year after Friend of the Earth in 2001. And so I was reading in the late 90s all the environmental writers, none of whom gives our species a breath of hope. And I'm trying to juggle that. And you know, it's bad enough that the world is a mystery and we don't know why we're here other than to reproduce as animals. But to think that the whole species will soon be eradicated is a little tough for any humanist to get hold of. And I was reading then Laurie Garrett's book, The Coming Plague. Again, this is the 90s when she was talking about what you mentioned earlier, the fact that we are creating a perfect laboratory for the bacteria and viruses and parasites of the world to mutate into forms which we can't resist. I mean, the airplane itself and wide travel. In the old days, plagues were limited regionally. Now that's not true anymore. And so in this story, After the Plague, I satirically deal with this and wonder about what it would be like to be a survivor. Also, you know, environmentalists, and I am one, are generally very liberal to left-leaning in their politics, except with regard to one factor, and that is immigration of any kind from anywhere, because the enemy is other people. So in such a scenario of after the plague, the narrative mentions that, you know, it's terrible that civilization's collapsed, but man, a lot of space on the freeway now, you know, lots of food.
Well, yeah, I mean, in science fiction, there's a famous thing called the cozy catastrophe, which is a story where everyone's dead, but it doesn't feel that way in the story because the protagonist is having such a great time with free cars and, you know, and that's kind of how After the Plague is, right? That he can just live in any mansion he wants. And
yes, yes.
But yeah, so, but what do you, going back to the question about the Mad Max type, you know, biker gangs and cannibals and stuff like that, how do you feel about those sorts of stories?
Well, we are living in that world right at this very moment as we are talking. We are the elite. We're the top of the food chain. We've got all we need. But one third of the people in the world are starving to death as we speak and don't have access to clean water. And at least a third of the countries in the world, maybe more, are run by gangs, bully boy gangs, who have taken over and seized control from Putin's Russia on down to the warlords of Somalia. So we're already living in that world. It's just that you and I are very, very fortunate in that we are not subject to the control of ISIS, who have taken over our village and have taken our women and enslaved us and so on.
No, I think that's absolutely true. And I mean, as I understand it, a lot of these civil unrest can be traced to climate change because you have these big droughts and things that...
It's just the tip of the iceberg. It is coming like you can't believe. So even... I think we're going to have to get into geopolitics here, but, you know, George Bush essentially created ISIS by destabilizing Iraq and so on. But there, it is a factor of climate change because in the Mideast, you know, you don't have sufficient water. So, okay, you have, we built desalination plants. You don't have sufficient resources. And so a gang arises and takes them. And they can have any sort of ideology they want, but really, it doesn't matter whether they are following the Quran rigidly as they claim, or as Stalin claimed, he was following, you know, the Communist Manifesto. It doesn't really matter. It's just a gang taking control so that they can have the resources and enslave you. It has existed since the world began. We're living in a period of it now. And as you say, with the increase of global warming, it would be a disaster. The same Elizabeth Colbert I just mentioned in the last issue of The New Yorker has a wonderful piece about the melting of the Greenland glaciers. This is going to raise the sea level several feet much sooner than we had ever dreamed by the end of the century, certainly. So all of the coastal areas will be inundated, and that means people have to move inland. Bangladesh, for instance, where are those millions upon millions of people going to go? What are they going to eat? Look at the disaster of the Syrian refugee crisis. We're humane, you know, and we want to help. But in essence, a lot of people are going to have to die.
Right. This is the sort of the lifeboat metaphor, right? That we can't just, there's not going to be enough room for everyone, for all the refugees created by the climate crisis.
Mm-hmm. But you may remember that I have a solution to all this, because on the Friend of the Earth tour, there was no good news. And, you know, during the Q&A after my my readings, I would, you know, field all these tearful questions and people were sobbing and so on. So I came up with this, which I think you may know. If everyone on Earth can abstain from sexual relations for 100 years. No cheating, by the way. The problem is solved. What do you think?
Well, yeah, it seems like, you know, to look on the bright side, Elon Musk will be okay on his in his dome on Mars, right? So that's kind of the optimistic.
Well, you know, I'm almost exclusively negative on the environment because it is overwhelming. We see in a single lifetime the radical transformation of the environment. But, you know, maybe it's too little too late, but when I was a kid growing up in New York, there was no notion of a limit of resources. No one even had heard of such a thing as recycling. Everything was thrown in the trash. I myself, in my little forest of an acre plus, I'm creating an environment for the animals. I recycle fanatically. I'm, you know, using all waste matter in mulch and throwing it on the bushes and creating a little sanctuary for animals. Okay, great. And there are many people doing this. But the tide of humanity is overwhelming it. It's optimistic that people are aware and we're talking about it, but maybe it's beyond the tipping point. I don't know. I hope not. I'm not a misanthrope. I love my fellow human beings, especially the women. And I don't really want to see our society and everything we love, David, our literature, our culture, just vanish. But it sure looks like it's going that way.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a question of whether we've passed the tipping point or not. But I mean, if you look at some of these electoral maps where they show, you know, what would the election look like if only millennials voted, mm-hmm. It kind of makes you think that, you know, if that continues into the future, we could have a political system that was way more active about dealing with some of these problems.
Yeah, good, as opposed to like the worst president in history, George Bush, who not only denied global warming as a shill of the oil companies who bought him into power, but then had his scientists falsify the global warming statistics from real scientists. Yeah, that would help. Yeah, okay. I mean, that is something to look forward to, I guess.
Well, because I do feel like, I mean, I feel like all these environmental issues are not so much challenging because of the physical realities involved, but because of the political realities involved. I feel like if we had a different political reality, they wouldn't seem as daunting as they do. And so, you know.
Yes, but don't forget, what has allowed us, again, to be sitting here, you know, I'm in a nice hotel room, you know, talking on a phone. I burn up lots of, even though I'm a conservationist, I burn up lots of resources on this earth, is capitalism. Capitalism itself is this big wheel we cannot get off of. It posits infinite consumers and infinite growth and infinite product on a finite planet. How could you back off from that? In 2003, I wrote A Drop City, which takes us to 1969, the Back to the Earth movement, the hippies, who felt that we should get off this wheel and live more simply and live in tune with the earth. And so I wondered about that, and I created a commune of hippies living in Northern California who moved to Alaska to live sustainably off the land in our final frontier. Would that be possible? So that is sort of like the Terranauts, which it takes that world under glass. This is going out into the world that's no longer available to us because it's been decimated. But again, the Back to the Earth movement was not possible simply because there are too many of us. One of the ironies there of living in Alaska in that era was that, you know, you're the top predator, like a grizzly or a wolverine. And there are always far fewer predators than there are prey, obviously, because of just the way the numbers are going to work. So really, you can live off the land if there are 7 billion people.
Well, right. But I think from our current vantage, capitalism does seem intractable. But taking a broader historical view, I mean, capitalism, as we know it, has been around for a few hundred years and may not be around for too much longer if the environment gets bad enough that people, you know, that the sort of free market fundamentalism just comes to seem absurd and untenable in the face of these upheavals.
But it's got to be a crash. Nobody's going to do it willingly and give up their Mercedes-Benz and whatever the hell else that we all have to have. I mean, we're sold product perpetually. Every minute of every day, we are sold product. I try to have solutions for these things. I am working in my basement lab now on a way of expanding the earth like a balloon so that if it works, you know, your house that you were living in Westchester, probably there's a house next door. Well, that house would now be a mile away. You see?
Yeah, no, that's good. That's good.
And then your plan, of course, with I thought that all of this transgenic stuff was the kiss of death. But right, we just make people 6 inches tall. And then there'd be a lot more to go around.
Yeah, that seems actually a lot easier to shrink the people rather than expanding the Earth, right?
Well, I'm working on both.
Well, yeah, if you could do both, that would be, you know, much, you know, you could multiplier effect there.
But it's so depressing, David. The world, when I was a boy, you know, I would always read about explorers and the jungle and all the creatures, the wonderful creatures out there, from, you know, scorpions to caiman to hyenas and all the rest of it. And the world was a big place still. Now, you know, we have to have sports and invent sports of extreme sports of climbing, it's this rock face and racing with, you know, monkeys on your back to see if you can do it. Because there are no frontiers. There is nothing left. There is no mystery to the Earth anymore. And what's left, let's say, in the Amazon is rapidly disappearing. So it's just, I mean, just idealistically, philosophically, in terms of the magic of life on this planet is so vastly reduced because of the plague of our species. I don't know how you can get around that.
Well, I mean, I would say as a science fiction fan that, you know, we just found out there are 10 times as many stars in the universe as we thought there were last year. And we have no idea what's on any of those hundreds of billions of stars.
Well, quite obviously, there is life in the universe just by an accounting of numbers. If there's life here and there are, you know, hundreds of billions of planets, well, of course there's life elsewhere. But what good does that do me sitting here in this hotel today?
Well, but see, you can read some science fiction novels and imagine what it would be like to explore those hundreds of millions of stars.
Well, true. Well, we know each other well, and you know that while I write what could be called science fiction in some of my stories and some of my novels, I've never read much by way of science fiction as a genre per se, so I really don't know. I'm coming from it kind of innocently, and you could be a far better judge of what I'm doing than I can because you write science fiction and have been invested in it for most of your life. I guess the scenarios I'm coming up with are science fiction. I mean, I was shocked that A Friend of the Earth was put on the science fiction shelf. My CRISPR story next week in The New Yorker is, I suppose, science fiction. And yet, I see them more as environmental stories where I'm projecting from the very concerns that we've been talking about here and imagining what scenario might result.
Well, right. Well, so tell us about the CRISPR story because I'm actually really curious about that.
It's called Are We Not Men? And it projects about 20 years into the future. And I'm dealing with the new gene editing technology, which allows us to make transgenic creatures very quickly and easily, as opposed to the last 20 years. And I'm just wondering about what the results of that will be. And so I'm creating some new transgenic creatures, like, for instance, the dog cat. And, you know, the commercial for the dog cat comes on. And the Pachelbel's canon is playing, and the announcer comes on in his soft voice and says, dog person? Cat person? It's all moot now. And I'm creating some new creatures, and also, of course, we will soon have transgenic human beings, no matter what the scientists say. I mean, what was it, a month ago, a Swedish scientist admitted to the world that he is doing gene editing on fetuses. Dead, but, you know, fetuses in his laboratory. So if he's admitting it, imagine what the Chinese and the Russians and the North Koreans and the rest of the world are doing. And in my telling of this story, of course, we will do it as well. We have to. And so we won't really be natural creatures anymore, but you could say that our brains have evolved to make us something else altogether. And that is in the near future. And it makes me uneasy, I suppose.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's certainly lots of ways it could go wrong, but there are also lots of upsides. I mean, I think that's the thing with technology is that people always tend to overemphasize the downsides.
Well, that's good, because then perhaps you become a little cautious. Right now, what they're telling us, scientists and governments, is that no, we would never consider messing with the human genome, except to, for instance, edit out the mutated gene that causes breast cancer, or to edit out a gene that will cause paralysis at birth or various genetic disorders. Who would argue with that? But of course, it's just a small step to deciding that you want a child who is 6'3" and has blue eyes or has musical ability or whatever. You take the genes of the two parents, and it's like placing an order at the car dealership. You can select the best possibility, no guarantee, of course, but the best possibility for these genes to give a certain trait in your offspring. That is a no-brainer. Look at the way parents vie to provide the best for their children and to get into the best schools and have the best coaches and so on. It's a small step to having genetically designed human beings. It's absolute. Since we have the technology, it will absolutely happen and happen very soon.
Yeah, no, I agree with that completely. I think it's so inevitable that we'll have to design our babies. I think it's even silly to dispute that at all.
Yeah, and so, of course, people like me always emphasize the negative aspect, and certainly there will be positive aspects too. Look at all the invasive creatures we were talking about earlier, and which I wrote about in When the Killing's Done. We will have new kinds of invasive creatures. The creatures I mentioned in Are We Not Men, the fun of this story is, toward the end, is a little list of the creatures that have been given us. And the dog cat, of course, and the crow parrot I've invented. But the others, which sound equally crazy, the super cow, the micro pig, and so on, they all are here now. The seahorse that has incorporated a gold dust in its genes. Why? Well, just for fun, like having Galagos in the biosphere. It's just for fun, you know, why not? But, or more to the point, the transgenic salmon, which we created before we had CRISPR technology, was perfected. So it incorporates only three genes of two other fish species into a normal salmon, and it allows the salmon to grow twice as fast. Okay, we need food. We're running out of resources. Hallelujah. But if the salmon should get out into the ocean, which they assure us it never will, it could outcompete the salmon we know, and they could be extinct. And we now have a world that is very much a science fiction world with creatures that did not evolve, but creatures that were created. And again, it goes back to what we're talking about in Ecosphere 2. Creating creatures or forcing them in Ecosphere 2, they would be forced to evolve in their own way. But we are jumping way out of evolution and creating creatures, some of them just quite fanciful, just because what the hell, let's do it.
Well, right. But I mean, is genetically engineering a dog cat all that much different really than breeding a wolf into a miniature poodle?
Yeah, good point. It is not different at all. All the dogs in the world, from the Pomeranian to the poodle, are all one species. They can mate with a wolf. They're still one species. But this is selective breeding, which has got us here. Yes, of course, we've done this. The thing is, it's accelerated now, and we can make creatures that are not one species. We can combine two species for our own purposes, and it can be good. I mean, the super cow just has had its genes edited so that it creates more muscle mass and more meat, just like this transgenic salmon, which grows at twice the rate of a normal salmon. This could be a solution to, you know, food problems on the Earth.
Right. Yeah. So the technology just has so much potential to solve problems. But then, as we mentioned, with genetically engineered swine flu or something,
of course,
it's very, very worrying.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. They're bioweapons. You know, if you have people dying for a cause as suicide bombers, this is one of the main armaments of ISIS, for instance, is a suicide bomber. Then the doomsday machine from Dr. Strangelove, why wouldn't someone unleash this? You know, the only restraint is, well, it'll kill you too. But if you're a suicide bomber or you have this hatred for the enemy, why not? So you die. They die too, you know. It's just a frightening new world we're entering.
Could you talk a little bit? I mean, you mentioned that you're writing some of these stories that are more along the science fictional realm. And you actually, you know, my producer and best friend, John Joseph Adams, he edited an anthology recently called
Yes.
Best American Science Fiction and Fantasy.
Yes.
And
mm-hmm.
he reprinted your story, the Relive Box in that. Yeah. And I was just wondering, maybe you could talk about that story.
The Relive Box is my take on gaming, how we are obsessed with virtual reality. And my joke, of course, is it's a good thing because real reality is going out the door pretty quickly. So in this, it's another of my inventions, which I hope to be marketing in a couple of years. It's like a standard gaming box. It has a retinal beam that only you can operate. You could be in a room doing it, and no one else can see what this produces. What it produces is you give it a date of your life because your memories have been put into it, and you can see in 3D the scene of any time of your life. You can't be an active participant, but you can relive any moment of your life.
Right. And so the story suggests that this would not be good for people, basically.
Well, I don't know about that, but look how obsessive some people have become with gaming as it is. Here, I suppose, on a thematic level, would it be better to actually live or to relive? Again, I would love to be able to relive moments. You enter a scene when you're 19 at the bar and you're trying to pick up a girl. What did you look like? What did she look like? What did she say? And of course, in my telling, people immediately go for the sex. But then my narrator, after he goes for the sex in such scenes, you know, 10 times, he then starts to notice other details of the scene. How he looked, what history was like, what it looked like around him. What did they actually say to one another, you know? All of that stuff is so fascinating because we only live in the moment and our recollection of the past is hazy at best.
Right, but the story seems to suggest that there would just be something irresistible about getting lost in the past that would be sort of make it hard to keep living your life in the present.
I think so, especially for people who are very disappointed with their lives in the present, which I guess is about 99.9% of everybody, right?
Well, so who isn't disappointed with their lives in the present, I guess?
Donald Trump. But he's going to be disappointed in 8 days, yeah. Oh, I don't know, David. But, you know, it's fun to talk with you because you are the science fiction guy. And I'm not saying that I am becoming one. I'm writing these stories out of a kind of innocence of what the science fiction world has done. I know that there are novels about terraforming and all sorts of fascinating things. I'm innocent of that. I'm just kind of blundering my own way forward, and I don't see myself as a science fiction writer. I'm just a literary writer who has a wide range of subjects and modes.
Well, I wanted to ask you, because in the Terranauts, the characters are reading some science fiction authors who are listed as Clark, Bradbury, Salmon, and Clayton Unger. I am not familiar with those last two. Are those real authors?
They're invented. Fidencio Salmon is a science fiction writer from Puerto Rico whom I invented, in the 1980s. He's the guy who wrote The Ravishers of Pentagord in Budding Prospects. And there's a story called Zapatos, which was in Harper's, I guess in the 80s, maybe 90s, I'm not sure. And it was written by Fidencio Salmon, However, I was the translator. And it was interesting. I got two letters from universities wanting me to intercede and see if Mr. Salmon could come to give a reading at the university. So he's an invention of mine, and I just have fun tossing him out there. Remember, Kurt Vonnegut created Kilgore Trout. So I've created Filencio Salmon. And Clayton Unger is an invention just for the Terranauts. But I guess I shouldn't tell everybody that, you know? I would like, it's in a Borgesian way, it's kind of fun to think that they would be searching the internet and writing letters to see if they can get a hold of Filencio Salmon.
Yeah. It was actually interesting when I was doing research for this. You actually have an entry on the Internet Speculative Fiction Database where whoever runs that site, I don't know, but they've gone through your work and listed the ones that they think would be of interest to fantasy and science fiction.
Oh, fans. How cool. I had no idea. How wonderful.
Yeah, so I would definitely encourage people to look up T.C. Boyle on the Internet Speculative Fiction Database. But some of these stories, it looks like they were reprinted in a number. It looks like you had a story in Asimov's magazine and the Twilight Zone magazine.
Yep.
Could you just talk a little bit about the history of your work appearing in fantasy and science fiction magazines and places like that?
Well, it always happened in a second serial rights sort of situation. These stories have been reprinted in what we would call literary magazines first. And again, early on in my career, I've been included a couple of times in the best science fiction of the year. And early on, I was included there when Terry Knight was doing the series. And he wrote me and said, you really puzzle me. You're this literary guy and you write these stories in The Atlantic and New Yorker and so on. And yet now you write these wonderful science fiction stories also. And I wrote him a long letter saying, well, I don't consider them science fiction. I've never read any. I don't know about it so much. I am coming out of this kind of 1960s and 70s kind of magic realism of Garcia Marquez and Cortázar and Borges and Calvino and even the American writers like Robert Coover and Pynchon and so on. The labels are so fluid and so strange to me. So anyway, I wrote him this letter, and then he just didn't print any more of my stories because I had said that they're not science fiction. But again, that's just a question of definition.
Yeah, and I mean, I think the definitions are becoming less and less relevant.
Absolutely. You're right, and I think that's a good thing. I think that's a very, very good thing. I'd be curious as to what stories are on this website. I bet there are a lot of them. I mean, if I look back, I've written probably 150 stories and 16 novels.
Yeah, well, I have them right here. I could just read them for you.
Yeah, read a few. I'd be interested.
Descent of Man, We Are Norsemen, The Champ, Bloodfall, On for the Long Haul, The Big Garage, Greasy Lake, The New Moon Party, Modern Love, Urban Renewal, The Miracle at Ballinspittle, Termination Dust, Carnal Knowledge, After the Plague, The Black and White Sisters, The Sisk U, July 1989, 1300 Rats, The Relive Box, and the Hector Quesadilla Story.
Wow. Well, that's great. I'm thrilled and honored. Again, I don't know if I'd say this is... Well, there's fantasy, there's science fiction, there is the surreal, there is magic realism. I mean, I don't know if we need to put labels on it. I would love to see somebody just do an anthology of those stories under that rubric,
Yeah, I'm sure I know some podcast listeners who would probably be interested in that.
Yeah, I think that would be great. Because my aesthetic, as you know, David, is that I have no limits. A lot of literary writers write from their autobiography or they write strictly in a realistic mode or whatever. I've never had any limits right from the beginning. Some of those stories you mentioned from my early work are just completely surreal. And for years, fans would ask me, well, why aren't you writing those stories again? But if you look through my books, there are a couple of them in every book. And I think my intention or my hope or my interest in the Relive Box and other stories was to write more of that sort of story. So as you'll see with Are We Not Men and a couple of others in this new collection would be put in an anthology of the stories you just read. But also there are stories that are straightforward realism, as I was saying earlier, like The Fugitive, which was at the New Yorker earlier this year, I think in June or May or something. I'm taking an environmental concern, and that is multiple drug-resistant tuberculosis, and making it into an ethical concern and a story about a guy who is a fugitive from justice, not because he committed a crime, but because he didn't take his meds and he is mutating a new form of multiple drug-resistant tuberculosis in his bloodstream, which can be transmitted to us by a cough, and is the tip of the iceberg of this kind of plague that we're talking about. Here, just a single human being is breeding it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, because when you talk about the artistic freedom, certainly the way that the world was presented to me when I was younger was you can either be a literary writer, in which case you write about the real familiar world around you, or you can be a science fiction writer, in which case you can write about anything you can imagine, but you can't write about the real world around you. And these are your choices, and it's kind of a shitty choice to have to make.
So we are breaking those boundaries down, you know?
Yeah.
It seems to be.
I did really want to ask you about the story of Bloodfall that I mentioned on this list, because that's one that's always really stuck in my mind. Could you just talk about how you came up with that story?
Very few of my stories come from a dream image, but that one did. And the dream image was simply blood on snow. And I don't know. All my stories and all my novels just begin with an image. And then I translate it into words, and I follow the words. I'm lucky to have a kind of innate gift of structure, I guess, which enables me to see what the story scenario will be as it progresses.
I mean, could you say a little bit about the characters in the story? My girlfriend and I reread the story last night, and she was wondering if the characters are part of a cult or something, because she said they all seem to be wearing white and have slippers and just seem sort of...
Yeah, sure. And it, of course, they're part of a cult. And it's also a kind of a little fable. And maybe it's my very first book and one of my early stories, and maybe it is. All the stories you mentioned that are from that book, but particularly that one too, might be kind of suggesting the themes and concerns that I finally have evolved in terms of the environment and the mixing of modes and my refusal as an artist to be limited to what I've already done before or what has already come before me, and just try to find my own way in any sort of mode at all. The foundation holds it all together is the language. I would think that if you know my work well, you could pick up a book blind and not know it's by me and read a paragraph or two and identify me. It has to do with style and the use of language and rhythm in a way that I suppose I can't adequately talk about. Someone else would have to do this. But we talk about style. If you love a rock and roll band, for instance, and you're listening to the radio, irrespective of just the chords, you hear a vocal, and you know immediately who it is. And I think that style has something to do with that in literature, too. You pick up a William Faulkner book, and you don't realize it's Faulkner. You just pick it up and look in the middle, and you read a paragraph, and you know it's Faulkner. So I think that's important to me, to be able to be identified in that way across all the boundaries of all of these various kinds of stories.
Yeah, well, so when we're reading the story last night, I mean, most stories, there are not words that I don't know in them, but there are quite a few in your stories. And so we came across in Bloodfall this word, fibrinogenification. Now, is that a sort of word that you're writing along and you pull that out of your head, or are you doing research on blood or something to write the story?
Most of the odd words I use are coming from research because I'm researching a given topic. And I use them for fun, for the most part, not to clobber the reader in any way. I guess it's part of my aesthetic. I don't know. Again, I've been lucky to kind of find my own way. And as you know, I never had any interest in doing anything but creating fiction. This is why I don't write essays much or participate in the movies or go to meetings or or care about pretty much anything else other than nature and writing.
Do you worry some if you're like in the Terranauts, the characters are all writing in the first person, and some of the things they write, I'm like, this is written so beautifully. There's no way these characters could have written this. It's too good.
I'm trying to replicate their voices and make their voices distinct from one another, but that is part of the agreement of fiction, which we make with the writer. You know, I am the one standing behind the characters, and you know that. But you can suspend that and just get into the characters themselves. But yeah, I wouldn't want to write something that isn't beautiful. That's just part of my aesthetic. In The Harder They Come from last year, part of the challenge was to channel the schizophrenic voice in a third-person voice. It's a little easier in third person because then the arrangement between writer and reader is that the writer is the god overseeing this. When you write in first person, you want the reader to believe that this person is real and would talk like this. All three of the characters, though, are pretty highly educated. And I'm not really having them talk to you. They're really writing to you. But yes, of course, all these considerations go into creating a character and the reader's belief in the character, sure.
Yeah. I guess I'm also just sort of curious, going back to the science fiction thing a little bit, you've had some stories in, like John Kessel had these anthologies, The Secret History of Fantasy and The Secret History of Science Fiction, and the best, you know, I mentioned John's Best American Science Fiction and Fantasy. Do you ever like get contributors' copies of those and read and look at them at all, or do you just have too many other things going on?
I'd have to say, David, choice B.
Yeah.
In fact, any anthology I'm in, I usually don't have time to go and sift through all the other writers and so on. It's an honor to be in these anthologies, but I am pretty much pedal to the metal. I mean, writing a book almost every year, and I have to tour a lot for my publishers here and abroad. So because I have a book just about every year, then I look back on the last quarter century and almost 2 months of the year is spent on the road, which is not really conducive to writing. I bring materials with me that I have to know for the next novel, sure, and read about it and think about it. But basically, on the road, I'm unable to write. And so my time is limited, and you know, I read for fun and amusement, as anyone else does, but I'm also, a lot of my reading has to do with science, because that's a kind of hobby of mine, especially particularly biological science, and also whatever material I'm working on for the next book. So that doesn't leave a whole lot of time, and you know, an anthology comes in the mail, and I might leaf through, maybe I'll read an odd story here and there. But basically, unless it really engages me, I've got 9 million other things I'm doing. Not to mention, you know, walking down to the bar and sitting there and drinking wine and going down, walking down to the ocean and watching the sunset and sitting out in my backyard watching the monarch butterflies mate in the air. So, yeah, it's a pretty full life.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because, you know, I don't know if you remember, but I had a story, Save Me, Please, and it appeared in John's Press Start to Play anthology alongside the Relive box. So I think that's the kind of thing, you know, as a young writer, you sort of fantasize that all the authors in the book are seeing your story. But
well, I am because I know you, but yeah. Some of the others, I don't know if I read through that anthology or not, probably not. And I don't want to diss anybody. It's just that I'm in a lot of anthologies, and I'm writing a lot of stories, and I'm all over the place all the time. And I don't think it's ever going to slow down for me, because I am lucky enough to be an artist and have an audience, and I just want to see what comes next. I never know what any story will be. And it's, as you know, it's so exciting to get out of your own brain for a while and to make something out of nothing and see it come together. It's almost a kind of magic. So I've not got to the end of that yet.
Has the touring, I interviewed Kazuo Ishiguro a while back, and he was saying that becoming like it's changed so much that touring has become so much of being a writer that it's almost like it feels like that's your job and the writing is an accessory to that.
I wouldn't agree. But you don't have to tour if you don't want to. I, as you know, I'm a showman. I used to be the singer of the rock and roll band. I love the audience. And I love what made us literary guys in the first place is being read to and hearing a voice and imagining a story, and you're sitting in a darkened room. I love nothing better than to project a story onto the audience. Yesterday I read Are We Not Men? I'm supposed to be reading from the novel, but I just told them about it, and I read Are We Not Men? And it blew them away. It was great. I could see them laughing and thinking and enjoying. It's something I really like to do. The problem is it takes you away from your real work, and the travel is terrible for your health. I've often said you put a normal, healthy man in a fancy hotel for a week, he'll be dead at the end of the week, you know? But I've lived with it for a long time, and I don't complain about it. I enjoy that portion of it. It's the exhaustion. When we first picked up the phone, I was telling you how tired I am from a different city every day, just being in the airport. You know, you got to get there, you're there, you wait online, you get on the airplane, you get off. Just that is utterly alien and exhausting to one of the chimpanzees of this world, of which I am one. I feel much better when I'm sitting by a stream in the woods, you know.
But you don't think publishers pressure writers to go on these long book tours?
I don't know. I've never felt that pressure. It's been a mutual agreement. I really want them to recoup their investment. I never became a writer in order to make money, and I've never thought of any kind of scenario to write that would make money. I simply do what I'm going to do because, as this whole conversation between us has shown, we are people who think deeply about things and want to express them. So, yeah, I want to help my publishers as much as possible, but I could say to them tomorrow, I'm tired, I'm not going anymore, that's the end of it. So maybe my book sales would decline. Maybe they wouldn't promote me as much. I don't know. You know, ideally, like in the old days of Hemingway, you write your book and you go, you know, go to Spain for 2 months, and maybe a month later somebody sends you a review and a check. But it doesn't work that way anymore because there are too many of us and we're all fighting for a limited audience and limited attention. So, David, let's have a final question or so and wrap this up because I've got to go in an hour or so and get myself ready for this afternoon gig I have today at the chapel in San Francisco where I am right now.
Oh, yeah. Well, sure. I guess I'll just ask if there's anything else just do you want to mention to our listeners, any other projects you want to mention or articles you've read that you liked or just anything you want to draw people's attention to?
Well, I think we've done that. I mean, we talked about Elizabeth Colbert's new articles, and we've had quite an extensive conversation here. I can't quite reveal what the next novel will be yet because I'm still just taking notes and thinking about it. But it will be an historical novel if it works, and it will be set in the early 60s. And it will have to do with the themes that kind of have been obsessing me over the last 15 books.
Okay, actually, wait, one other thing. So this is going to be the last, now that I think about it, this is going to be the last episode that airs before the election. Mm-hmm. So do you have any preference about the candidate who says that climate change is a hoax invented by the Chinese?
I am a lifelong left-leaning Democrat, and I think the Republican Party is completely bankrupt. They had to appeal to the lowest common denominator in the party, the radical fringe Tea Party people and the fundamentalist religionists and so on. And in this totally inappropriate buffoon of a candidate who will soon vanish back down the stinkhole of reality TV where he belongs, they are getting their just desserts, which is why they're all bailing out of him. I think this would be the greatest landslide in American history, and the danger is we'll be getting close to being a one-party system because, I mean, look who they ran last time, Mitt Romney. Who would vote for Mitt Romney unless you happen to be a billionaire dedicated to screwing people over yourself? At least he'd been the governor. You know, I'm ashamed for America that this is the best they can do.
All right, so I think that's a good note to end on.
Yes, David. It's great to talk with you. good luck in your new digs in Queens.
Oh, no, thank you so much. And so the book, again, it's called The Terranauts. The author is T.C. Boyle. And so, Tom, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
And that was our interview. So big thanks again to T.C. Boyle for joining us on the show. And as Tom mentioned right at the end there, my girlfriend Stephanie and I just moved in together in an apartment in Queens. We're really excited to be able to spend more time together. The apartment is reasonably close to where Stephanie works, and I'll also be a lot closer now to all the literary events going on in New York City, which I think will really benefit this podcast. The downside is that New York City, as you probably know, is ridiculously expensive, and so paying New York City rent is a big new expense for me as a poorly paid writer/podcaster. So financial support from our listeners would really be appreciated now more than ever. So as always, you can sign up to give us a dollar or two per episode over at patreon.com/geeks. And if you'd rather make a one-time or fixed monthly contribution, you can do that via PayPal over at geeksguideshow.com/crowdfunding. And I'd like to give a special thank you to longtime listener Rory Carroll, who just made a very generous contribution to the show via PayPal. So big thanks again to everyone who's contributed. We really appreciate it. All right, so that was our show. So thanks everyone for listening, and we'll see you next time.
The Geek's Guide to the Galaxy is a production of Wired.com. For more information about the show, visit geeksguideshow.com. To learn more about your host, visit davidbarkirtley.com. Music and voiceover produced by yours truly, Jack Kincaid. If you enjoyed this program, tell your friends. If you didn't enjoy it, tell no one. Thank you for listening.